नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जयमुदीरयेत्। नष्टप्रायेष्वभद्रेषु नित्यं भागवतसेवया भगवत्युत्तमश्लोके भक्तिर्भवति नैष्ठिकी। कृष्णस्वधामोपगते धर्मज्ञानादिभिः सह कलौ नष्टा दृशामेष पुराणार्को धुनोदितः। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। So thank you all for coming. It's a pleasure to be here for a second day. The topic of this seminar, as Neelamani Prabhu mentioned, is the glories of Srimad Bhagavatam. This is a topic that's one that's been on my mind quite a bit in recent times, because myself and Krishna Kshetra Prabhu are working on a couple of books for Columbia University Press on Srimad Bhagavatam. There's an amazing interest in the Srimad Bhagavatam within academic circles, and that includes within universities and amongst students and so on. Quite amazingly, there's been very little research or very little work done on Srimad Bhagavatam in the academic realm. So if you talk to the average person who studies Hinduism and you ask them, what are the most famous books from India, sacred books from India, what are they likely to say? Yeah, Ramayana, Mahabharata, including Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads, right? This is kind of the typical list. And in terms of books that have had influence or shaping influence on the culture of India and the culture of Asia, actually, as a whole, at the top of the list are, of course, Ramayana and Mahabharata. These two works have basically shaped all of Indian civilization and even civilization outside of India, like Southeast Asia and the rest of Asia, and now in the West as well. Actually, I had a request. Would everyone mind coming a little closer? This way I have to work less hard, and also when more people come later, then they don't have to walk through you to get to the front. So just don't be shy. Yeah. And if the wall is a backrest, bring the wall with you, and you can relax here. Yeah, cozy. of these different literatures, Bhagavatam, it's part of the top three in terms of works that have shaped the culture and history and tradition of India. There's no doubt about it. Some would even place it above the Mahabharata in terms of the amount of market influence it's had in over the period of history. You know, Mahabharata has become very famous in recent years with the television serial, with B.R. Chopra's, you know. But before that, Mahabharata was not something that was very popularly recited. Bhagavad Gita was, but much more popular in terms of recitation and reading and understanding and drama and dance and enactment was Srimad Bhagavatam. It was the Bhagavata Purana. And if you count the number of works that was, number of times the Bhagavatam has been written down in manuscripts, so different manuscript libraries around India, the number of translations you find in different languages, different versions of it in every single Indian language, from Gujarati to Marathi to Punjabi to Tamil to Telugu, everything. And if you count the amount of effect it's had in terms of dance, drama, music, it's phenomenal, right? This book that we're working on, it's a collection of different articles on Bhagavatam by scholars who study the text from different kind of perspectives, different areas of vision. And There's an article, for example, on the influence of Srimad Bhagavatam on classical Indian dance. And someone's writing a beautiful article on this song. How does it go? I think it's a Kannada song by in Madhvacharya's tradition. Very popular. Krishna ne. There you go. Yeah, thank you. And the whole kind of performance and the dance of that, which is straight from Srimad Bhagavatam, actually, and one of the most popularly and well-known ones, kind of sequences in terms of Bharatanatyam dance. Similarly, we have a beautiful article on music and the Bhagavatam's influence on classical Indian music, as well as philosophy and theology and so on. So the point being that when it comes to influential works, Bhagavatam is right there at the top, and it continues to be to this day. The amount of ways and times in which the Bhagavatam is recited and told, both in formal settings but also in families, parents and grandparents telling their children, there's basically no escaping Srimad Bhagavatam. And yet, most of us know very little about the extent of the glories of Srimad Bhagavatam. Means there's a reason why Bhagavatam has had the power and the influence it has in history. Right? It's not just a matter of coincidence or good luck or something. There's so many Puranas, Vishnu Puran, Skanda Puran, Padma Puran, Brahmanda Puran, Garuda Puran, this and that, right? So many different Puranas are there. But Bhagavatam has especially risen to the top. And that just doesn't happen just by coincidence. There's very good reasons. There are ways in which Srimad Bhagavatam is an unparalleled spiritual work. Every single one of our acharyas in our tradition, all the way from Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself, Rupa Goswami, Srila Jiva Goswami, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Baladeva Vidyabhushana, into the modern world with Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and our own Srila Prabhupada, they spent their whole lives studying Srimad Bhagavatam, writing on Bhagavatam, reading about Bhagavatam. Jiva Goswami's main work in life was the Shatsandarbhas. It's all about Srimad Bhagavatam. Srila Prabhupada's main work in life was his translation and commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam. So what is it about Bhagavatam that such great acharyas, such great thinkers, such capable artists and cultural elite of such an ancient culture would make this work their life's devotion? There's got to be something very special about it. And for us, of course, it behooves us to know and learn Srimad Bhagavatam very well, very carefully, because this is our main source of knowledge. It's, in fact, directly Krishna himself come in this age. It says, the last verse I recited is from Bhagavatam. It describes itself. It says, Krishna swadhamo pagate dharma jnanadibhisah kalau nashtadrishamesha puranarko dhunoditah. That in this age of Kali, when Krishna has already left, Krishna swadhamo pagate, he's gone to his swadhama, his own abode. And who went along with him? Who did he take with him? Dharma and? Jnana. Dharma jnanadibhisah. He took knowledge and all forms of religiosity with him. Right? God goes and everything goes with him. Right? And so what are we left? Kalau nashtadrisham. Right? In Kali Yuga, our vision is completely destroyed. Nashtadrisham. We can't see a thing. The sun has disappeared. Right? So we're all in the dark. Kalau nashtadrisham esha. But there's hope. Purana arko dhunodita. But this Purana arka, this beautiful sun of the Bhagavata Purana, udita, it's arisen. It's risen, and now we can see again. So it's directly Krishna himself. Purana Brahma Sammitam, it says in Bhagavatam. It's non-different than Brahman. It's the absolute truth. Non-different from Krishna himself. In fact, the acharyas describe that each canto of Srimad Bhagavatam is one of the limbs of the Lord. It's his full body. So the first canto is his lotus feet. And then you move upward, second canto, third canto, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, like that. Until the tenth canto is what? Yes, his beautiful face. And the five chapters of the Rasa Lila are his smile. Right? The Rasa Lila Panchadhyayi. So Krishna's whole form is there. We can have full darshan of the Lord just by knowing Srimad Bhagavatam. One time I remember in Boise, my Guru Maharaj, Hanumat Preshaka Swami, he was there and he asked us in a morning class, he said, so how many chapters does the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam have? And we were all, we don't know Maharaj. Okay, how many chapters does second canto of Bhagavatam have? Sorry, we don't know. Can you name some of the chapters from that? We named a couple, you know, this, that. Bhishma Dev is there and Queen Kunti is there. And Maharaj looked at us and said, you know, if Krishna came in front of you, you wouldn't be able to distinguish his lotus feet from the feet of a buffalo. Right? What's the difference between Krishna's feet and the feet of a buffalo? Right? You don't know. We don't know. Right? Unless we know Srimad Bhagavatam. That's the direct and only clear description we have of Krishna's form. If we know Srimad Bhagavatam inside and out in detail, then we know every aspect of Krishna's beautiful body, his form, so that we can actually have darshan of him now, and if one day we were fortunate to see him face to face, we would actually recognize him. Because that, of course, is not an obvious fact. We think, oh, Krishna would show up, I'd definitely notice, right? But not necessarily. In fact, when Krishna did come to earth, the vast majority of people didn't even recognize him, right? Not just a few missed him, but most people didn't notice him. Or at least they didn't appreciate him fully. They thought, oh, maybe he's just a... You know what the Kauravas thought, right? You think, oh, Krishna is doing so many magical things. He gave Draupadi his sari and everything, right? So how could they not think that he's God? What did they think, you know? What was their idea of Krishna? How did they explain all of this and still continue thinking that Krishna is not God, that he's just an ordinary being? Yeah, they thought he's just a really good magician. They thought, you know, he's a trickster and he's a good magician. We've all got magical qualities. In that age, it was true. Duryodhana was actually a pretty good magician also. And everyone had some yogic siddhis. It was just a common thing. Just like these days, you know, in this audience, we've all got an education and we know certain facts about our own field and so forth. It's no big deal. You know, we drive a car and we've got certain Aishwarya. We've got certain opulence that's given, that's assumed in our society. So at that time, it was assumed. Everyone had some yogic siddhis and, you know, you could... Okay, maybe you couldn't show up from Dwarka all the way to Hastinapur in an instant and give thousands of feet of cloth, but you could do something similar. You know, maybe go from Hastinapur to, I don't know, Kurukshetra or something, you know. It was like everyone had... So they thought Krishna's just a little bit better than us. That's all. He's just a little bit extra. And they missed him completely. Right? So that when Arjuna is saying, it was Arjuna and his devotees like that who saw Krishna's real identity. Param Brahma, Param Dhamma, Pavitram, Paramam Bhavan. Right? That was quite an amazing thing that he recognized Krishna like that. Not everyone could do it. So the point being, same thing with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, right? That when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared, he was Krishna himself. But many people could miss him because they thought he's just a little bit better than I am. A little more beautiful, a little more devoted, some miracles he's doing, you know? And this is Krishna's trick. Whenever he appears at the level appropriate for that yuga and just a little bit more. So that only his devotees recognize him and everyone else will miss him. When Hiranyaksha saw Lord Varaha, he didn't think he was God. He thought, wow, you know, a super pig. You know, this is what he thought. That's all, you know. So at that time, it was quite common to have big animals flying around and floating. Or maybe it wasn't common, but he didn't think of it as quite an amazing thing, right? But his devotees recognized him. Immediately they knew, this is the absolute truth. This is the Supreme Lord. He may be dressed like a boar, but this is actually who he is. His hairs are the mantras of the Vedas. Right? This is amazing. So the point being, we shouldn't assume that we know Krishna just because We can recognize him in the temple in the form of the deity. That's Krishna's mercy. But if he were to show up, we may not notice him unless we've done our homework, right? We know what to look out for when Krishna comes. And the only way we can know what to look out for is through Srimad Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam is the complete description of Krishna's wonderful form, his characteristics, his qualities. And we can know Krishna very intimately through the study of Srimad Bhagavatam. In fact, not only can we know Lord Krishna, but we can know just about anything there is to know in this world. Srila Prabhupada, he says several places, he says, all knowledge that can be found anywhere is found in Srimad Bhagavatam. All knowledge in the world, in every field, and he lists a whole number of fields, astronomy and biology and physics and chemistry and nuclear science and theology and philosophy, and everything is there in Srimad Bhagavatam. It's complete, complete knowledge, complete wisdom. So this is kind of the reason for diving into the Bhagavatam more deeply. And in order to begin our session, I want to read a couple pages from Srila Prabhupada's preface to Srimad Bhagavatam. This is not the introduction, before that. It's just 2 pages long. And as I mentioned last night, I think this is one of the most beautiful pieces that Prabhupada ever wrote. I mean, of course, everything he wrote is beautiful, and we all have our preferences. But for me, this is just, it's stunning, the language and how clear he is in terms of his mission statement. That what his goal is, why he's translating Bhagavatam, and the glories of Bhagavatam. So it's 2 pages, it'll take about 5 minutes, but please pay attention, listen carefully, okay? And then go home and read it again yourself. We must know the present need of human society. And what is that need? Human society is no longer bounded by geographical limits to particular countries or communities, right? He starts with the broadest possible vision and hits the nail on the head. We live in a globalized society. This is what, now 30 years ago, 40 years ago that Prabhupada is writing? Things were not even that globalized by then. Maybe even more when he was actually writing this. Yeah, more like 50. And yet, just right on the mark, right? Human society is no longer bounded by geographical limits to particular countries or communities. Human society is broader than in the Middle Ages, and the world tendency is toward one state or one human society. The ideals of spiritual communism, according to Srimad Bhagavatam, are based more or less on the oneness of the entire human society, nay, of the entire energy of living beings. The need is felt by great thinkers to make this a successful ideology. Srimad Bhagavatam will fill this need in human society. It begins, therefore, with the aphorism of the Vedanta philosophy, janmadyasya yataha, to establish the ideal of a common cause. Human society at the present moment is not in the darkness of oblivion. And Prabhupada is giving credit to our technological scientific advancement. So it's not in the darkness of oblivion. It has made rapid progress in the field of material comforts, education, and economic development throughout the entire world. But there is a pinprick somewhere in the social body at large, and therefore there are large-scale quarrels even over less important issues. It's such a nice way to put it. There's a pinprick somewhere in the social body. You know, if you've ever sat on a pin accidentally or inflicted that on someone else. You know, in grade school, sometimes they put upside down tacks on the teacher's seat or something. It's just a little pinprick, right? Not big deal. It's the whole body's there, just a little. But it can be majorly disturbing, right? Whoever sits on that pin or steps on it is furious. They want to know who the culprit is and get him. So this is a very apt analogy. Everything is perfect in our world, in our society. We're making rapid progress. But somewhere there's a pinprick, there's a problem. And because of that, everyone goes on fighting, wars and wars and wars. There's need of a clue as to how humanity can become one in peace, friendship, and prosperity with a common cause. Srimad Bhagavatam will fill this need, for it is a cultural presentation for the re-spiritualization of the entire human society. Okay, hear that again. It is a cultural presentation for the re-spiritualization of the entire human society. Srimad Bhagavatam should be introduced also in the schools and colleges. for it is recommended by the great devotee, student devotee Prahlad Maharaj, in order to change the demoniac face of society. Komaram acharet pragnyo dharman bhagavataneha durlabham manusham janma tadapyadhruvamat arthadam. Disparity in human society is due to lack of principles in a godless civilization. There is God, or the Almighty One, from whom everything emanates, by whom everything is maintained, and in whom everything is merged to rest. Material science has tried to find the ultimate source of creation, very insufficiently. But it is a fact that there is one ultimate source of everything that be. This ultimate source is explained rationally and authoritatively in the beautiful Bhagavatam, or Srimad Bhagavatam. The word Srimad means beautiful, right? So when we say Srimad Bhagavatam, we mean beautiful Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam is the transcendental science, not only for knowing the ultimate source of everything, but also for knowing our relationship with Him and our duty towards perfection of the human society on the basis of this perfect knowledge. It is powerful reading matter in the Sanskrit language, and it is now rendered into English elaborately, so that simply by a careful reading, one will know God perfectly well. So much so that the reader will be sufficiently educated to defend himself from the onslaught of atheists. Over and above this, the reader will be able to convert others to accepting God as a concrete principle. Srimad Bhagavatam begins with the definition of the ultimate source. It is a bona fide commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. Okay, all these different aspects we're going to talk about in more detail. It is a bona fide commentary on the Vedanta Sutra by the same author, Srila Vyasadeva, and gradually it develops into 9 cantos up to the highest state of God realization. The only qualification one needs to study this great book of transcendental knowledge is to proceed step by step, cautiously, and not jump forward haphazardly, like with an ordinary book. It should be gone through chapter by chapter, one after another. The reading matter is so arranged with its original Sanskrit text, its English translation, synonyms, translations, and purports, so that one is sure to become a God-realized soul at the end of finishing the first 9 cantos. Okay? So here's a guarantee from Prabhupada. He's saying, if you read this Bhagavatam, not haphazardly, okay? I don't know about all of you, but I have this tendency of picking up a book and reading from the middle, or reading from the end, or reading just from here and there. Right? If you get some book in the store, you might do this kind of thing. He's saying no. With Bhagavatam, start from verse number 1, work your way up to the end of the 9th canto. And Prabhupada is guaranteeing, by the time you reach the 9th canto, if you study sincerely and thoroughly, you will be a God-realized human being. Okay? You will know what the Supreme Absolute Truth is. Of course, that's not the end of our spiritual journey. That's just step 1. But it's a pretty big step, right, to be God-realized. Next thing, he says, the 10th canto is distinct from the first 9 cantos because it deals directly with the transcendental activities of the personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. One will be unable to capture the effects of the 10th canto without going through the first 9 cantos. The book is complete in 12 cantos, each independent, but it is good for all to read them in small installments, one after another. Then Prabhupada speaks very humbly. He says, I must admit my frailties in presenting Srimad Bhagavatam, but still I am hopeful of its good reception by the thinkers and leaders of society on the strength of the following statement of Srimad Bhagavatam. Tadvag visargo janataga viplavo yasmin pratishlokam abadhavatyapi namanyanantasya yashonkitaniyat shinvanti gayanti grinanti sadhava. And the translation is, on the other hand, that literature, which is full of descriptions of the transcendental glories of the name, fame, form, and pastimes of the unlimited Supreme Lord, is a transcendental creation meant to bring about a revolution in the impious life of a misdirected civilization. Such transcendental literatures, even though irregularly composed, are heard, sung, and accepted by purified men who are thoroughly honest. Om Tat Sat, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. So this is how Prabhupada begins his life's work, his life's mission. And he begins it with all humility, but 100% confidence. He's saying, this work, it may be full of faults, but the result you're going to get is going to be faultless. It's going to be perfect. And in fact, as we'll see, there's nothing about Bhagavatam that is irregularly composed, and there's nothing about Prabhupada's translation of Bhagavatam that is irregularly composed. And hopefully that's something that will emerge by the end of this seminar. Okay, so what makes Srimad Bhagavatam so special? Okay. Bhagavatam lays out its goal or its purpose right in the first few verses. It starts off in a very bold way. Okay, here's verse number 2. Dharma projita kaitavotra paramo nirmatsaranam satam. Dharma projita kaitavotra paramo nirmatsaranam satam. Vedyam vastavamatra vastu shivadam tapatrayon mulanam. Vedyam vastavamatra vastu shivadam tapatrayon mulanam. Srimad Bhagavate Mahamunikrite Kimva Parairishwara. Srimad Bhagavate Mahamunikite Kimva Parairishwara. Sadhyo Hridyava Rudhyate Trakritibhi Shushrushubhi Tatkshanat. Beautiful, beautiful verse and very bold. The first thing Bhagavatam says in terms of its own mission statement, okay, right at the beginning, a work is supposed to lay out what it's going to be about, what its purpose is. And the first thing it says, Dharma Projita Kaitava. This work rejects all kinds of cheating religions. Dharma Projita Kaitava. Kaitava Dharma, cheating religions. Now, this is a very significant fact. Where does Bhagavad Gita end? What's the last instruction of Krishna in Gita? Sarva dharman parityajya. Give up all dharmas. Where does Bhagavatam begin? We've given up all those dharmas. Dharma projita. Krishna's instruction in Gita is in the active form. It's an order. Sarva dharman parityajya mamekam sharanam vraja. He's using it in the imperative. Do this. Right? Give up all dharmas and surrender to me. Bhagavatam begins with a past participle, past tense, projita, which means it has been given up. Dharma projita. All dharmas are done with. They're finished. So Bhagavatam is saying, I'm going to start where Bhagavad Gita leaves off. This is why Prabhupada said, Gita is BA, Bhagavatam is MA, PhD. He said, it's the next step. And this is very clear. You can see this from Bhagavatam. You see, why giving up dharma? We go through our whole lives talking about dharma. Right? As Indians, this is what, if you ask anyone, what is the mission of life? Well, do your dharma. Right? Or what is Krishna saying in the Gita? Do your dharma. And that's, in general, it's good for human society. There's four things that comprise human society's goals. Right? Dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. These four things. Do religious activity. Why? So that you get things from God. You live a comfortable life for artha purposes. Life is good when you're religious. And what do you want all that money for and that comfortable life? For kama, for enjoyment, for sense pleasure. And then when you get sick of all of that and you decide actually there's no happiness in kama, then you think, okay, let's turn towards moksha. And so most people, as they grow older, they want to become more spiritual or religious. This is the typical trajectory of human civilization, not just in India, but anywhere in the world. This is how human beings operate. Bhagavatam says we're giving up all four. All of them are rejected right at the start. There's no point in doing dharma, and therefore the results that dharma can give you, namely artha, kama, and moksha, are also useless. They're no good. There's no point to them. Now that's a pretty radical statement, because it throws out the window just about every form of religious practice that we're used to doing. It throws out the window even one's goal. If you ask people who are very advanced and broad-minded, what is the goal of life? They won't say money or opulence or whatever. They'll say liberation, moksha, mukti. And Bhagavatam, no. Even that is not what we're interested in. Dharma projita kaitavotra paramo nirmatsaranam satam. Right? But if you have any envy in your heart, so Bhagavatam lays out what its prerequisite is, okay? That what's required in order to appreciate what's here. If you're actually looking for those types of things, then you won't be satisfied with Bhagavatam. Go somewhere else. There's other shastras available also. All those shastras are there for a reason. There's nothing wrong with them. If you want to get a religion that'll serve your material needs, that'll make us rich and happy with nice kids and a good family, if that's the kind of religion we want, then Bhagavatam is saying, that's okay, but you're not going to find it here. Right? Go somewhere else. Go to some other text, some other Purana, some other religious tradition. No, not here. All of that is gone. Nirmatsaranam satap. In order to appreciate here, you have to be completely free of envy. And that means free of selfish desire and free of pride. Nirmatsaranam satam. Because why? Vedyam vastavam. This is the real truth. Right? We're not going to cheat you here. It's not kaitava. It's not going to cheat. What's the definition of cheating? If someone asked you, just define cheating. What does it mean to be cheated? What's the broadest possible sense of cheating? Yes, Prabhu. Presenting something which is not. So say you're going to the market and someone promises you, you're buying some piece of electronics, right? And you get home and it turns out to be a plastic toy. And then you've been cheated. You were promised one thing and you were given something else in return, right? So why is it saying all these dharmas are cheating? Why is Bhagavatam calling all other forms of dharma as cheating religion? Because we go into, yes. So there's temporary stuff. Yes. What are we expecting? And what do we get? Right? Those are the two key things. You go to buy a laptop. You're expecting a good quality electronic product. And you come home and you find a toy that's made of plastic. You've been cheated. Right? You were expecting one thing, promised one thing, and you're getting something else in return. So we go into religion expecting what? Everlasting happiness, right? What did you? Happiness, exactly. Right? You're looking for everlasting happiness. You're looking for peace in life. And what do you get in return? Just temporary results, right? Krishna says, antavattu phalam tesham tad bhavat yalpamedasam. He says, you've been cheated. Right? This is why you have small intelligence, alpamedasam, choti buddhi. Right? Why you've been cheated? You went to the market and you didn't know what you were looking for. You were expecting ultimate happiness and instead you came home with what? Just temporary pleasure. So Krishna is saying, you're stupid because you do this, and the person who's doing this to you, Bhagavatam is saying, they're cheaters. It goes both ways, right? The person who's doing it to you is a cheater, and the person who is cheated is foolish. You should be smart enough to know. If you go out to shop for gold, Prabhupada says, and you have no idea what gold looks like, well then, you know, you have no idea to judge gold, you're going to get cheated. You can't, you know, really blame anyone for that. You have to go into the market with some basic amount of knowledge. You're going to buy a house, you need to know what types of things you need to do. Get an appraisal done and get a check on the foundation and the structure and so on. So you don't move into the house and realize the roof falls out, you know. If you don't have that kind of basic knowledge, then it's no good. So Bhagavatam is saying, dharma projita kaitava, we're rejecting all those. And what we're going to give you? Vedyam vastavam. It's only the absolute truth. Not only that, not only is it true, but there's one more important quality. Shivadam. It's also good for you. It's also pleasing. It'll also make you happy. Tapat trayon mulanam. It's going to get rid of all your suffering, all your misery. Three tapas, caused by ourselves, by others, and by nature. It'll make you happy also. So it's, in other words, the Bhagavatam saying, this is not the bitter truth. It's truth that's actually very pleasing, very good for you. And therefore, the verse ends with this wonderful question. Kim va parair? Why do you need anything else then? Right? Why do you need anything else? It's like you have to take medicine to cure your illness. But then on top of the medicine, you have to also have a teaspoon of sugar because the medicine is bitter. Right? But if you've got medicine that's good for you and also delicious to eat, just like all these diet books and the fads you hear, they're all the best diets they promise. Eat as normal, enjoy as normal, eat what you like and still lose 20 pounds. Right? That's their promise. And we know, of course, that's never true. Right? Keep your lifestyle exactly the same. Right? Eat whatever you want and take this pill and 20 pounds in 2 weeks. Right? You'll lose it. And we know, oh, that's kaitava. That's cheating. Right? That's not going to happen. No pain, no gain. But Bhagavatam, this is what it's giving us. He's giving us something that's actually good for us. It's the medicine we need, and it's the best tasting thing in the world. And that's what Bhagavatam emphasizes in the next verse. This is the topmost form of philosophy. It's the highest truth. It's the absolute truth. But at the same time, what makes it special, what makes it wonderful, okay? Because you could say, okay, it's giving you the absolute truth. It's rejecting all dharma, dharma projita. But then doesn't Bhagavad Gita do that also? It gives you the absolute truth. Are there not other scriptures that give you the absolute truth? And the answer is yes, there are. Not many, but there are a few that don't cheat us. But Bhagavatam has one more thing that puts it above the pack, that makes it the best. And what is that? What is that one more thing that the Bhagavatam has which definitely puts it in a unique position? Self-realization can be offered in many different shastras. Right? That's the first step in spiritual life. And in fact, even some kaitava dharma, even some texts that, you know, aren't fully honest. Yeah? It's spotless, yes. Krishna's manifest in the pages of Bhagavatam. So what is the quality of the Bhagavatam, that attribute which makes that evident? Yes, yes. Next verse says, Nigamakalpataror galitam phalam shukhamukhadamritadravasamyutam. Nigamakalpataror galitam phalam shukhamukhadamritadravasamyutam. Pibata bhagavatam rasamalayam muharaho rasika bhuvibhavuka. Pibata bhagavatam rasamalayam muharaho rasika bhuvibhavuka. Here's the Bhagavatam's command. Krishna's command in the Gita is give up all dharmas and surrender to me. Bhagavatam says, that we've done already. Okay? Giving up dharma, surrendering to Krishna, done. What do we got to do now? He says, Nigama kalpa taror galitam phalam. This Bhagavatam is the Nigama kalpa taror. Nigama means the Vedas. Kalpa taror galitam phalam. It's the ripened fruit of the Vedic desire tree. And Prabhupada explains this very nicely in the purport. He says, the reason the Vedas are compared to a kalpa vriksha, a desire tree, is because all knowledge in this world is found within the Vedas. So any authentic knowledge you have is Veda, actually. It's part of the Vedas. In other words, the Vedas are not like set works. We think of them, four books, Rig, Yajur, Samana, Tarata. But actually the Vedas are an ever-expanding body of knowledge. Anything that's actually true, it's Vedyam, is Veda, right? It's knowledge. So of all the types of knowledge that may exist in the world, that includes engineering and includes computer science and programming and everything, it says, galitam phalam. This is the fruit of that tree. Why do you raise a tree? For its fruit. Sometimes fruits can take a long time to show up also, like almond trees or cashew trees. They bear fruit like 12 years or something after you first put them in the ground. Sometimes they take even longer than that, 40, 50 years, to bear fruit for the first time. So sometimes you have to wait. But galitam phalam. Not just any fruit, it's galitam. Now, you know this word galitam, right? In Hindi, we have the same word. Gujarati also probably. When we say galgaya, you know, what does galitam mean? Yeah, ripe to the point of overripe. It's galitam means... The translation is like dripping with juice, oozing. That's how soft. That's the type of fruit it is. It's ripe at the peak of its perfection. So that Pibata Bhagavatam Rasamalayam. He's saying, drink that nectar. This fruit of rasa, drink it. This Bhagavatam, what makes it unique is rasa. That whereas all other literatures may give us, tell us something about religion, very few literatures tell us religion with no cheating means the absolute truth. And of all of those literatures that teach us religion with cheating, only the Bhagavatam mixes that absolute knowledge with pure, nectarian, juicy rasa. And the Upanishads, they say, raso vai saha. The Lord is in fact rasa. So this is where the Bhagavatam begins. This is in fact our definition of God as the supreme reservoir of all rasa. And Sridhar Swami, in his commentary on that verse, he says, the Bhagavatam is asking us to drink this fruit, right? To drink this fruit. But he said, how can you drink a fruit? In order to drink the fruit, you have to do what? You first peel it, right? And then you have to put it in a juicer. And there's one thing you don't want to get into the juicer, which is the seed, the pit. You don't want to get it in there. And then after you finish juicing, there's still something that comes out the other end. All this fibrous stuff, which is not part of the juice also. So what do you mean, drink this fruit? And Sridhar Swami says, the nature of Bhagavatam as its fruit, the only reason Bhagavatam says, drink this fruit, is because this is a fruit with no skin and no seeds. It's a fruit only made of juice. Now, an unimaginable type of fruit. Even an orange needs something to hold the juice in. Right? But this is a fruit with no seed and no skin. And therefore, you can just drink it. In other words, remember that the skin and the seed has already been rejected. Dharma projita kaitava. It's already gone. All the extra stuff, useless stuff, we don't need. So it's just the rasa. Just the rasa. And so in Bhagavatam, you find that every single katha, every single story that's there, is told specifically with the intent of bringing out the rasa, or the relationship between the Lord and his devotees, the emotional exchange between Krishna and his devotees, bringing that out to the front. This is the primary intent of every story that the Bhagavatam tells. In fact, the stories that the Bhagavatam tells are not unique to the Bhagavatam. For example, the story of Prahlad Maharaj and Narsingadev is found in just about every Purana. It's not a new story that the Bhagavatam tells. But when the Bhagavatam tells it, it tells it in a special way, in a different way. What is that special way? What's unique, do you think? Can you guess? I know we've not read all these other Puranas. But from the Bhagavatam's version, what's the emphasis that emerges from Bhagavatam? Yes, the philosophy is very strong, but more than the philosophy even. God will always protect his devotees. Yes, so what's the focus of the story? It's Krishna. Krishna is not the focus. That's the point. And who's the focus here? Prahlad Maharaj, right? Prahlad's philosophy, definitely. But Prahlad in every aspect of the matter. You know, the story of Nrisimhadev comprises 10 chapters in Bhagavatam. Practically, it's one of the, I think it's the longest running story outside of the 10th canto. Bhagavatam devotes so much time on the story of Nrisimhadev, 10 chapters. And you know how many of those chapters deal with Prahlad Maharaj? 100% with Prahlad Maharaj. 7. 10 chapters. This is supposedly the story of Nrisimhadev. And 7 of those chapters are about Prahlad Maharaj. And when Prahlad Maharaj first shows up on the scene, this is in the second chapter of the series, you know what he's doing, how he's described? Does anyone remember? He's in the middle of and ecstatic symptoms. Right? He's experiencing trembling and tears are flowing from his eyes. And it says that even though his father was a demon, he would spend his time in the palace experiencing all the transformations of bhakti that we read about in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's character, for example. Prahlad Maharaj was experiencing that mood of deep separation. And it says that sometimes he would see the Lord in his meditation and he would start jumping up and down in ecstasy. And everyone would look at him and go, what's wrong with him? The king's son is going crazy. Right? But he couldn't control himself. And other times he wouldn't see the Lord and he would cry and tears would come from his eyes. And he couldn't control himself. That's how we meet Prahlad Maharaj for the first time in Bhagavatam. In every other Purana, Prahlad Maharaj is just a supporting actor. Right? He's just on the side. Nrsingadev is the main attraction. Right? He shows up in the tear. And of course, it's very dramatic in Bhagavatam also. But for Bhagavatam, that's of secondary interest. What Bhagavatam is primarily interested in is the devotee and the relationship between the devotee and the Lord. This is what the Bhagavatam is concerned about. And Prabhupada has some very beautiful purports in this section. I encourage you to go back and read it, where he describes how there's a mood of intense Vatsalya Bhav between Prahlad Maharaj and Lord Nrsingadev, where Lord Nrsingadev is in the fatherly mode. And Prahlad would call out to him like a little child calls out to his father. Right? That's how we meet him. And then you get the prayers of Prahlad Maharaj, and then you get the instructions of Prahlad Maharaj to his schoolmates, and you get Prahlad Maharaj's wonderful qualities, and you get the conversation between Prahlad Maharaj and Hiranyakashipu, and then, by the way, also Nrsingadev shows up too. Right? That's the uniqueness of Srimad Bhagavatam. Look at also the story of Ritrasura. You know the story of Ritrasura? This story of Indra killing Ritrasura is one of the oldest stories in Vedic literature. You find it all the way back in the Rig Veda. You can Lord Indra there is praised as the killer of Ritra, the great demon. This is one of his greatest accomplishments in the Rig Veda. Every Vedic literature from the time of the Rig Veda downward has told the story of Ritrasura again and again. Bhagavatam does too. But you know how Bhagavatam tells the story? What happens in the Bhagavatam that's interesting or unique or different? Anyone know? Yeah. You see, the story of Ritrasura, he used to be King Chitraketu in his past life. And he was cursed by Mother Parvati because he laughed at her and Lord Shiva. They were engaged in intimate relations and he laughed at her. How are you doing this in front of others? And she got upset and she cursed him to become a demon. And Chitraketu, he comes as Ritrasura. And Indra, he is supposed to kill Ritrasura because he's becoming incredibly powerful and the demigods are, of course, afraid of him. So he gets this whole special arrangement done, gets a thunderbolt made and special weapon and this and that. It's a big thing. And then Indra comes to fight with Ritrasura. And it's very funny what happens, actually. The battle is not going too well for Indradev. It's not going well. Ritrasura is very strong. And Indra's finding it incredibly difficult to kill him, even though he's used to killing demons pretty easily through his thunderbolt. So what Indra does is he sits down and he gets all dejected and depressed. And he says, oh, gosh, this is not going well. My God, maybe I should give up. And you know what Ritrasura does? Instead of attacking him, using that opportunity to attack him, he goes up to him and says, come on, Indradev, what are you doing? Right? It's already been predicted you're supposed to kill me. You have to do it. This is your duty. And this is, in fact, the will of the Lord. I'm a demon. You're a demigod. You're supposed to kill me. Right? This is the way to properly... I can't keep living. Right? I'm a demon. And demons can't run this world. And he goes and he preaches to Indra and says, come and kill me. And Indra says, oh well, okay, sure. Let's go kill you. Right? And he gets up and he starts fighting. And then they have this wonderful discussion where Indra actually turns around and he says, That's true, Vritrasura. You can come and say that because you're a great devotee of the Lord. Right? You're a Mahabhagavata. But I'm not like that. I don't have those qualities. So it's difficult for me. I get dejected and depressed. But you can, it's amazing you can maintain your enthusiasm even though you've lost one arm already and you know you're going to die. And still you're so happy. Right? But I'm not like that. And he goes and he admits it and he praises Vritrasura. And then Bhagavatam says, and then they both pick up their weapons and they continue with their duty of fighting. It's just their dharma. It's okay, we got to kill each other, so fine. You know, we'll do it. And in the end, this big, big bad demon ends up being such a wonderful devotee of the Lord. And the hero of the story becomes not Indradev, as he is in the Rig Veda and all these other Puranas. The hero of the story becomes Vritrasura. Just like the hero of the story in the story of Nrisingadev is no longer Nrisingadev, it becomes Prahlad Maharaj. And you can give so many examples like this. In the story of Vamanadev, again a story found over and over and over again in so many Puranas. In fact, all the way in the Rig Veda again, Lord Vishnu is called Trivikrama, the one who makes three steps. In fact, when we praise Lord Vishnu, Om Tad Vishnu Paramam Padam Sada Pashyanti Sure, he's taking three steps in these verses. Very famous. And the hero is Lord Vishnu, that he can encompass the world in three steps. And Bhagavatam, in fact, is not so impressed by that. You know what the Bhagavatam is really impressed by? Yes, Bali Maharaj. He turns out to be the hero of the story. And everyone comes out praising him. And Krishna ends up becoming his doorkeeper in Patala Loka. Who's the real hero of the story? It's Bali Maharaj. And his mode of Atma Nivedanam, complete self-surrender. The last example I give is the story of the Ramayana. Sometime, go back and read these two chapters in 9th canto, Ramayana, the Bhagavatam's Ramayana, and read it carefully and see what is the Bhagavatam interested in. Right? What aspects of the Ramayana story does the Bhagavatam highlight? Because that'll give you a good idea as to what the Bhagavatam finds valuable. What is the Bhagavatam's emphasis? And therefore, what should be our emphasis as devotees? You know, when this story begins, Shukadeva Goswami tells Parikshit Maharaj, he says, "My dear king, you've heard the story of the Ramayana so many times. Already by 5,000 years ago, the story of the Ramayana was already millions of years old. And it was already the most well-known story in creation. The Ramayana is called Adikavya, the first piece of poetry. It's actually a wonderful topic. One can give a... Yeah, one. Anyway, so the Bhagavatam is Adikavya, the first piece of poetry. And it's been around for years and years. And so Parikshit Maharaj says, look, you already know the story of the Ramayana. So let me just tell it to you in briefly. Right? Just because it's enjoyable. No one ever gets tired of hearing the Ramayana, right? It's always an ever-fresh story. So let me hear it again. Parikshit Maharaj wants to hear it again. So he tells it briefly. But it's Shukadev Goswami telling it, right? So what Shukadev Goswami is really interested in, that's what's interesting. All the aspects of the Ramayana story, there's two things about it that the Bhagavatam emphasizes. It draws a lesson in two different ways. The actual story, in terms of Lord Ram did this, and he did this, and he did this, and he did this, and then he went to the forest and he killed these demons and he sliced off the nose from Shubhnaka and like that. All that, Bhagavatam goes really fast, you know, get the plot in. And then where does Shukadev Goswami stop? He'll tell half of Lord Ram's life story in one verse, and then he'll stop and give three verses on just one little thing. And you know, can you guess what types of places he stops? To savor it? To taste the rasa? What do you think likely places would be in the story? Likely candidates for the story? Yes, but tell me, not people, I mean incidents. Right? What moments in the story? Vibhishan surrenders, okay. What else? Yeah, when Lord Ram loses Mother Sita, looking for her, that separation that he feels, the agony of losing Mother Sita, Bhagavatam gives two lessons from that. You know the first lesson? It's quite shocking. What is the Lord teaching through this? Yes, the first thing he shows, the Bhagavatam says, is in this way Lord Ram shows the fate of someone who is too attached to a woman, right? Or for a woman the other way around, for a man. Right? What happens when you're too attached to the opposite sex? This is what, and you end up suffering like anything. Because one day or another you're going to lose her or lose him. Right? If not now, then at death. So it's going to just be a source of suffering. Now imagine, growing up in India, hearing the story of the Ramayana, have you ever heard that as the lesson of the Ramayana? Right? What are you going to typically hear? This is the example. Lord Ram is showing how a good husband should protect his wife. Right? Lord Ram is showing how much love there should be in the family. Parivar mein kitna pyar hona chahiye. This is the point. This is why people like the Ramayana over the Mahabharata. It's a story of family love. But Bhagavatam is saying the opposite. And if you first read it, I remember the first time I read it, it felt like a slap on the face. Like, what do you mean? This Lord Ram is showing this. It's like the backwards, you know? And then you realize, nah, Bhagavatam's not going to beat around the bush. Right? This was the promise right at the start. Dharma projita kaitava. We're not going to turn around and tell you something that makes you feel good about your life and your situation. Family love, everyone be attached to each other, you know, and then die one day. And sorry, I forgot to tell you about the suffering that was going to come. But you never asked, did you? No, Bhagavatam is not going to do that. The Bhagavatam is saying, look, this is the truth. If you don't like it, go read another version of the Ramayana. There's plenty. And they will all do you good. There's nothing wrong with them. But if you want Bhagavatam's version, then be prepared to get the truth and nothing but the truth. That's what's coming. But then the second lesson the Bhagavatam takes from that. See, it's not all just negative. What's the second lesson? Anyone know? What's the other lesson? This is a higher lesson. So this is on the material level. So on the spiritual level, what do we see? What is Lord Ram showing? Vipralamba Bhav. That the intense, actually, happiness that Krishna feels, but also it's a bittersweet happiness. Right? This ecstasy he feels in separation from his devotees. That mood of separation, love and separation, which is such a consistent theme throughout Bhagavatam, love and separation. Prahlad Maharaj, you know his main emotion, his main feeling towards the Lord? Love and separation. The gopis, their main feeling towards Krishna? Love and separation. Bhagavatam is really big on this Vipralamba Bhav. Right? And so he says, he's showing, in fact, he's tasting, he's experiencing this highest rasa, which is love and separation. So that's the rasika bhuvi bhavuka part. So both things are there. In the same verse, in the same story. Dharma projita, no nonsense, here's the facts. And at the same time, muharaho rasika bhuvi bhavuka. Taste it, right? Once you get rid of all those attachments, once you see the facts, you're prepared to digest them, then the rasa you're going to feel is like none other, right? It's no longer a story of material love and attachment. This is an attachment, an affection that goes far beyond anything we can imagine in the material world. So Shukadeva Goswami pauses his story to taste this rasa. Another place he pauses again to taste rasa is in Ram Bharat Milan. Right? First, the separation between Ram and Bharat. Again, what's the mood there? Vipralamba Bhav. Love and separation. My Lord is gone. And Bharat's heartbreak when Lord Ram left. And then the intense happiness when they meet again. He's telling the whole story in one verse. He spends two verses talking about Ram and Bharat. And like this, over and over again, he'll stop when there's something to taste, something to savor there. And therefore, Bhagavatam behooves us. It says, those, oh you who are rasikas, who are connoisseurs of rasa, who can distinguish different flavors, who can enjoy them, who know how to taste and appreciate them, right? Drink this nectar of the Bhagavata. But you have to be a rasika for that. It's not easy. It's just like, it's kind of a backwards analogy, but wine tasters, right? Those who taste different types of wine, these connoisseurs, you can go to wine tasting events and so on. And they'll blow on it, and they'll sniff it, and this and that, and they'll swirl it around. And it's like, for the average guy, it's like, what difference does it make? Drink the wine, it'll increase your alcohol content in your blood, and you'll feel good. Right? That's it. But for wine tasters, like this. You have to know. And then they'll write reviews. This has a slightly, sweet and tangy flavor. This one has a leathery taste to it. What does that mean? Yeah. But to them, it means something. This is a smoked feel crossed with cherry. Hello? What's that? You know? But they know. Why? Rasika. And other rasikas can... In fact, it's actually a translation of the word rasika. The word rasa means wine or alcohol also. Rasika is a wine taster, right? Someone who's a connoisseur. Prabhupada makes this point in Gita, you know? He says in his lectures on Gita, when Krishna says, rasoham apsu konteya, I am the taste of water. Prabhupada saying another meaning of rasa is also alcohol. So even the alcoholic can know Krishna through his alcohol. I'm the taste of that beer you're having, right? In Sanskrit, rasa means also. It means not just any juice, but fermented juice, alcohol. And so rasika, yes, you have to be a rasika in order to appreciate it. And therefore, to be a rasika, you're never a rasika by birth, right? No one grows up being a wine connoisseur or being a cheese taster and knowing all the different types of cheeses in the world, right? You need training for that. Right? You need to be educated. You need to be trained. You need to be practiced for that. And therefore, in order to appreciate Srimad Bhagavatam, we need to go to those people who are truly rasikas, and we need to learn from them how to taste the various flavors and mellows of Srimad Bhagavatam, how to experience them, and how to enjoy them and appreciate them. Because not everyone can appreciate it in the beginning. You may not, far from appreciating, you may even misunderstand. It's just like if any of you have tried different kinds of cheeses, like French cheeses and so forth, right? I don't know, blue cheese? Anyone like blue cheese around here? It's an acquired taste, to say the least, right? The first time I remember, I thought, oh, blue cheese, very interesting. How do they make it blue, you know? And the first time I tried blue cheese, oh my God, I realized what it was blue because of, right? It's actually all mold. It's fermented, and the mold is growing inside the holes inside the cheese. And so that's what gives it its unique, quote-unquote, fragrance, right? So unless you're a connoisseur, you cannot appreciate blue cheese or brie or whatever. And all these cheeses, they can have very weird flavors. But you develop the right taste under the right guidance, and suddenly you start liking it. Right? So the point is, it's admittedly a backwards example, but the point is, Bhagavatam, you need training, right, to taste it. And if we don't have training, we can even misunderstand the text. And Prabhupada was especially very cautious about this in the 10th canto. And he said, unless you do it in proper guidance, you come to the 10th canto and you can actually become offensive in your mentality and mistake these highest levels of rasa to be just ordinary lust. And then you're not rasika, right? You're kami, kamika, right? Just tasting cheap kama, that's all. It's the difference between connoisseurs of wine and cheap beer. Right? It's a world of difference. No, this is not the way. And therefore, in order to understand Srimad Bhagavatam, we need to understand it through our acharyas, through this process of parampara. No one appreciates Bhagavatam as do the followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Right? No one. It's just a fact. Even those who are not members of our sampradaya will tell you that the commentaries written by the Gaudiya Vaishnavas on Bhagavatam are just out of this world. They're just incomparable in nature. So, what I want to do in the rest of the seminar, is give you a taste as to what our acharyas, how they approach Srimad Bhagavatam, what conclusions they draw from Bhagavatam, and how they determine the ultimate meaning of Srimad Bhagavatam. Okay, it's lots of very interesting, very fun stuff, especially from Jiva Goswami, with a little activity as well involved in it. So, but before we go into that kind of section, let me pause here and see if there's any questions or any areas you'd like elaboration. Yes, Prabhu.
On that second, on the second verse of Bhagavatam, where it says that Vyasadeva composes in his maturity, it somehow leads us to believe that he was immature at some point.
Yeah, so the question is, when the Bhagavatam says that the that Vyasadeva composed this work in his maturity, then it somehow leads us to believe that Vyasadeva was immature at some point. How do we understand that? And the answer, quite frankly, was that he was immature before he wrote Srimad Bhagavatam. Of course, we know that he's the literary incarnation of the Lord. So he's empowered by the Lord to do this work, this seva. So therefore, it is the Lord's lila, in the sense that just as Arjun was immature in his thinking at the beginning of the Gita, but Prabhupada explains that this is for the purpose so Krishna can give the instruction of the Gita for the welfare of humanity. But in terms of that lila, we see very clearly that Vyasadeva was... In fact, this question leads me to two important things that I wanted to point out. We also understand why the Bhagavatam is the topmost of Vedic literature for two very important reasons. Namely, its context. Jiva Goswami in the Sandarbhas, he gives several different reasons why the Bhagavatam he regards as the topmost literature. We'll go through these reasons step by step. Okay, but the most important ones is the context of its recitation. Namely, when and why and how it was composed. I want to go into that more. It's a very interesting topic, but let me not go too far. Okay. So I'll answer that question in more detail soon. But if there are any other questions that you have in the material so far. Anything else? Okay. So let me then complete that point. Yeah, I think we can finish this before our first deadline here. Jiva Goswami, he begins, he wrote the Bhagavata Sandarbha, it's called the Shat Sandarbha, six different Sandarbhas. And he wrote them primarily with the interest of explaining the meaning of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Because the Bhagavatam, he describes as the topmost work, topmost literature. Now, Jiva Goswami's goal in the Sandarbhas as a whole is to establish the philosophy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as the highest or the topmost philosophy in the world. Right? This is the first time in the history of our sampradaya that anyone has given a complete, a systematic description of our philosophy and argued for it. Okay. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he didn't give us too much by way of written works. He gave us the full philosophy of Krishna consciousness by teaching his disciples and by living his life perfectly. But in terms of writing, all he wrote were the eight verses of the Shikshashtakam. So he told his immediate disciples, the six Goswamis, to systematize and to clearly articulate our entire Gaudiya Vaishnava Siddhanta. The first person to do that completely and fully within our tradition was Srila Jiva Goswami. Because Rupa Goswami wrote the definitive work on Bhakti Rasa Shastra, namely Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, or Nectar of Devotion. Srila Sanatan Goswami and Gopal Bhatta Goswami wrote the definitive work on how we do puja as Hari Bhakti Vilas. They also wrote wonderful commentaries on 10th canto Bhagavatam, namely Vaishnava Toshani. But if you were to look for one place where our entire philosophy was given systematically and completely as a whole, the only place you find that is in Jiva Goswami Sandarbhas. the Shatsandarbhas. So the six Sandarbhas, Tattva Sandarbha, Bhagavat Sandarbha, Paramatma Sandarbha, Krishna Sandarbha, Bhakti Sandarbha, and Preeti Sandarbha. These six take us all the way from Sambandha to Abhidheya to Prayojana, the full spectrum of Krishna consciousness. And he argues it in such a way that even someone who's not a believer in our philosophy will be forced to accept its authenticity, its veracity. It's a very, very strong philosophical argument. Prabhupada, he said that Jiva Goswami was the greatest philosopher who ever lived. And this is a whole nother topic, a different seminar. But, you know, there's studying Jiva Goswami's works, there's nothing in comparison in terms of how profound his writing is and how detailed and therefore how difficult it is also. But his primary goal in these sandarbhas is to prove the supremacy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy. And in order to prove the supremacy, he has a very simple methodology that he uses, okay, a simple tactic. He shows, first of all, that the highest pramana, or the highest source of knowledge in this world, is Srimad Bhagavatam. Then he shows that the Bhagavatam is in fact teaching Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy. Right? Therefore, the conclusion is what? That Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy is the highest, it's the topmost. Right? If the highest source of knowledge is Bhagavatam, and Bhagavatam is teaching Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy, then what the Bhagavatam is teaching has to be the highest. It has to be the supreme truth. This is his strategy. Now, the first step of the strategy, each one of these steps is related to Bhagavatam, okay? But the first step is very crucial. Namely, that he needs to show that the Bhagavatam is the highest source of knowledge. And that's not an easy thing to do, because we have in Vedic tradition, we have so many different shastras and so many different literatures and books, and they're all very good and they're all authentic and so on. So how do you show that the Bhagavatam is the highest? This is what he does in the first sandarbha, Tattva Sandarbha. And he has a really, really nice, well-developed argument. The first thing he says, or one of the things he says, is that we can tell from the context or the circumstances under which Bhagavatam was written. You see, Bhagavatam was composed by Srila Vyasadeva. He wrote it. Now, Vyasadeva is the author of the entire Vedic literatures, or at least their compiler, from start to finish. So he writes the Vedas. He divides them into four parts. He arranges them. He teaches them to his disciples. And in this way, he begins four lines of Vedic teachers. This is why in India you have, you know, Dvivedi and Trivedi and Chaturvedi and so on. Different lines of teachers who know the Vedas. Then, after the Vedas, Upanishads, okay. Brahmanas, Aranyakas, Upanishads. After all of that is done, he thinks, well, what about those people who don't happen to be Brahmins and very learned? What about everyone else in society, which is 99% of everyone else? And so once he's done doing that, he writes, what's next? The Itihasas, right? Specifically the Mahabharata. He compiles the Mahabharata. After he's done with all of this, he's sitting there and thinking, you know, I'm just not satisfied. I don't feel good about what I've done. I've produced amazing amounts of literature that have changed the world, but I'm still not happy. I still feel that something is wrong. And as he's sitting there dejected, his spiritual master comes, Narada Muni. And he says, I'll tell you why you're feeling dejected. All this you've just written, you know what he calls it? Jugupsitam. Jugupsitam. In Sanskrit, that word is a really heavy word. It's not like bad, you know, it's not like it's inadequate, it's not good. The word jugupsitam is the type of thing a teacher would never want to tell a student, right? Your work is jugupsitam. It means abominable, despicable, sickening. Jugupsitam, right? Something you don't want to get close to. He says, this, all this stuff you've written is jugupsitam, he says. Imagine the shock this would have caused him. Excuse me? But this is the role of the guru, right? The first thing the guru does, ashocha anvashochastam, pragnyavadam. Krishna does the same thing. Who do you think you are, Arjun? Speaking such learned words, you're a fool. This is the guru's role, kind of shake up the disciple. So he has his attention. He says, all you've written is jugupsitam. And Vyasadev, what? But Mahabharata, right? Vedas, Upanishads, Puranas. And he says, yes. Why? There's only one reason. Because through all of this, you have never glorified and described the activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. Through all these literatures, you don't glorify the activities, that which can truly satisfy the soul. Yayatma suprasidati. This is why you're not feeling satisfied, and anyone who reads your books will not feel satisfied. In fact, what does he say? You've cheated them. You've cheated them. And therefore, when Vyasadeva begins this Bhagavatam, what's the first thing he says? Dharma projita kaitava. He says, Guru Maharaj, I'm not cheating this time. This is it. This is the real thing. Right? Enough with that. I promise I'm going to do it for reals this time. And so therefore, when he says, Kimba parair, what's the use of any other literature? You know it's coming from the right place. Why? Because he wrote all those other literatures. So he has the right to say it. It's not me or you coming along and saying, oh, this is the best book, I think. No, this is not New York Times bestseller list based on what consumers think. No, it's the author himself saying, everything I've written, you know, like you have the early Shakespeare and the middle Shakespeare and the late Shakespeare. They study different authors and so on. And it's basically, it's like the late Shakespeare saying, everything I wrote earlier is all nonsense. Vyasadeva is saying it's no. Kimba parai. Why do you need anything else after Bhagavatam? This is it. This is final. So it's composed in the maturity of Vyasadeva's vision, of Vyasadeva's knowledge. So you can be sure, because I haven't read all the Vedas. I don't think anyone here has read all of the Vedas. I haven't even met one person who's read Mahabharata cover to cover and not just seen the television serial. Right? Or even Ramayana for that matter. Right? Valmiki Ramayana. We don't have that kind of knowledge. So who are we to make judgments? But one person who has read it all is Vyasadeva, because he wrote it. He's the author. So he gives his verdict on what his best writing is. That's one reason the Bhagavatam is topmost. Second reason is the context, the second layer within the Bhagavatam. So the first layer is Vyasadeva. What's the second layer? Vyasadeva is writing this original text. Then what's the next outer frame of Srimad Bhagavatam? Where does it go to next in the parampara? Shukadeva Goswami, right? Shukadeva Goswami speaks to Maharaj Parikshit. That layer also provides evidence of the supremacy of the work. Why? Because Shukadeva Goswami, who was he? Son of Vyasadeva, and completely liberated soul. In fact, he didn't come out of the womb for 16 years in his mother's womb. My wife just went through pregnancy, and you can imagine what that's like, right? 16 years in the womb. She had to carry him. 16 years, and he wouldn't come out until he was guaranteed. Yeah, he was a teenager by that time. until Krishna himself came to him and it said, you come out and I promise you, you will not be affected by Maya. You're not going to fall into Maya. You're not going to become attached. I promise you, my personal guarantee, God himself. And so he says, okay, I'll come out. And the minute he comes out, he walks away from home. And Bhagavatam has this beautiful verse. Vyasadeva goes running behind him and calling out, said, my son, he putra, putreti, Bhagavatam says. Oh my son, come back. 16 years we... and now you're leaving, right? Hey Putra, come back. And do you know the reply he got? Only the trees echoed his words. Only the trees echoed, Hey Putra, Hey Putra, that's all. That's how liberated he was. And yet, that Shukadev Goswami returned. Vyasadeva did get him back. And he did this by sending his disciples to the forest where Shukadeva was living. And he said, I want you to go on the pretext of getting firewood and collecting fruits, and you sing the verses of Bhagavatam as you're doing this. And when Shukadeva Goswami heard these verses being chanted, he couldn't help it. It's like the Pied Piper. And he just attracted by it. And he came home. And he learned Srimad Bhagavatam Vyasadeva. So his father and mother got an opportunity to give him something. Now someone who's purely liberated, who's perfect in every way, why would he come back to study anything? If you've already made it, why would you come back to study anything? What's the answer? Why would you come back? Studies is for someone who's trying to get somewhere, right? Trying to figure something out, to become self-realized. If you're already perfected, why would you come back to study anything? The highest truth, but he knew the truth already. Yes. Yes, that same verse. And therefore, Vyasadev puts this in the third verse. He says, Moho raho rasika bhavibhavuka. It's because it's relishable. And Bhagavatam says this in a beautiful verse. Atma ramas jamunayo nirgrantha yap yurukrame kurvantyahi tukim bhaktim itham bhuta guno hari. Atma ramas jamunayo nirgrantha. Even those people who are atma rama, who are completely satisfied in their own self, they have atma gyan and brahma gyan, nirgrantha, and they're free of all granthas. Grantha means knots, ties in this world. All their knots have been cut. Pidyate hridaya granthis, chidyante sarvasangshay. All their doubts are gone. All their attachments are gone from this world. Everything, they're completely free. They're still. Kurvantya hai tukim bhaktim. Even those people do engage in the Lord's bhakti, especially hearing and glorifying, chanting the glories of the Lord. Ittam bhuta guno hari. This is because the Lord's qualities are so wonderful. Ittam bhuta. Just imagine how wonderful the qualities of the Lord are. Guno hari, that he comes back. He who is completely absorbed in nirguna brahman, who's understood everything about the world and reality and so on, he comes back just because that taste is irresistible. So therefore you know that what the Bhagavatam gives has to be more than anything else that one might get in through spiritual realization. Okay? So the first level, Vyasadeva writing it in his maturity, proves that the Bhagavatam is the topmost. The second layer of the story, namely Shukadeva Goswami speaking it to Maharaj Parikshit, proves that the Bhagavatam is the highest. What's the third layer? Suta Goswami speaking to Shonaka and other sages. How does this layer prove Bhagavatam supremacy? Thousands of sages are gathered at the end of Dwapara Yuga. They've been doing a fire sacrifice for thousands of years. It says for 1,000 years they did this yajna. Their bodies are black with the soot of the yajna. And they're sitting there for 1,000 years going, Swaha, Swaha, Swaha. All the great minds of this creation. And at the end, the last Swaha, they put everything down and they say, forget it, this is not working. Right? What's the point? 1,000 years we've been getting our bodies black with soot. And what's the point? We're not getting what we're actually looking for. And what were they looking for? Some solution for Kali Yuga. What are these poor people in this age going to do? We're men of Dwapara Yuga. We lived in that age, right? Lord Krishna was here. Everything was still decent. Now Kali Yuga is starting. What hope is there? They're sages, they're rishis. And the primary quality of sages is that they're mahatmas. They're very compassionate towards other living entities. And so they're worried, what's going to happen to people like us? How are we going to survive in this age? And so they do a grand yajna to try to figure out the answer. And in the end, they can't figure it out. And finally, they turn to Shonaka Rishi and they say, what should we do? And Shonaka Rishi says, actually, there's one book I read which saved the life of a man in 7 days, right? Which was capable of liberating a person in 7 days' time at the end of Dwapara Yuga. I heard this from the mouth of Shukadeva Goswami, the most learned of all these people. Let me tell you now. And they say, yes, please. And then they sit and they listen. And the result they were looking for over 1,000 years of yajna, they found in just a few days of listening to Srimad Bhagavatam. Krishna Swadhamo Pagate Dharma Jnana Adibhisa Kalau Nashta Drishamesha Puranarko Dhunotita. He says, this is the answer for those whose vision has been blurred by Kali Yuga. So at every layer, first layer of Vyasadeva, second layer, Shukadeva Goswami, third layer, Suta Goswami. At every layer, you find that the evidence shows that the Bhagavatam has to be the ripened fruit of all Vedic literature and the ripened fruit of every spiritual practice or process prescribed in the Vedic literature. It has to be. Because otherwise, these sages wouldn't be wasting their time with something like that. So, one is based on the context of Bhagavatam. That's one argument. Jiva Goswami makes another argument. He says, all the Vedic literatures require some kind of adhikara to learn. If you want to study the Vedas, first of all, you have to be a brahmana. That means you have to be twice born. Now, we understand that doesn't mean by birth. But still, you have to be up to a certain level of qualification. Be twice born, initiated, upanayana ceremony, etc. You have to be very learned in Sanskrit. In fact, so learned, because if you even mispronounce one little syllable in your study or recitation of the Vedas, you could quite literally be risking your life. Because we know from the story, you know, the Vishvarupa and Tvashta, just one little syllable you pronounce in the wrong way, in the wrong place, and you can actually get the opposite result. You have to be very learned. You have to be a brahmana. You have to know Sanskrit. You have to be well educated. And generally, it was mostly men who did this. Just a fact. The Vedas, very limited, very restricted. But the Puranas, they're called the Panchama Veda, the fifth Veda, the Puranas and the Itihasas. And what makes them even higher or greater than the Vedas is their accessibility. That they provide the same truth, but in a far more accessible manner. And something that is accessible is always superior to that which is inaccessible. If you can present the same thing, in other words, the product is the same, but if you're making it accessible, then that is higher. It's a better product. Just like the internet has been available for decades, right? But only now is broadband available to every household, right? That's supposed to be an improvement, an upgrade. It's a better product when it's more accessible. Education, always people educated. Now we have mass education. So we're trying to get to 100% literacy rates. Okay. So accessibility, Jiva Goswami's point is, Bhagavatam makes these highest truths accessible. Therefore, it's higher. The content is higher, as we've read, but also the presentation is higher. It's a better teacher than others. The third thing he says, okay? So, this is how he makes the argument. Amongst all the Vedas, the best amongst all the Vedas is the fifth Veda. the Itihasas and Puranas. Why? Because they present the same truth in a manner that's accessible, number one, and number two, in a way that's clear, that's not hidden. The Veda, the meaning of the Vedas is very difficult to understand, especially in our age, and the Upanishads. They make very kind of opaque, difficult to understand statements. Anyway, if you read the Upanishads, it's all, the mind is made of food, right? They'll say. And then you need to explain that. What does it mean, mind is made of food? So it requires lots of explanation, argument. But the meaning of the Puranas is crystal clear. They explain the meaning of the Vedas, in fact. So it's clear and it's accessible. This is why they're higher than the Vedas. And then, of all the Puranas, the highest, he says, is Srimad Bhagavatam, amongst the Panchama Veda. And he gives so many nice forms of evidence. One is, of course, the context part, which we've talked about, Vyasadev, Shukadev Goswami, etc. But the other thing he says is because the other Puranas acknowledge this fact. And he gives quotations from a variety of different Puranas, which say that of all the different Puranas, the Bhagavata is the greatest. Imagine. This is supposed to be Bhagavatam's competition, right? And the competition comes out and says, you're a better product than we are? I mean, you should be listening, right? It's probably going to be truthful. What's in their interest to come out and say that the Bhagavatam is better? It's not like it's going to increase their readership, right? It has to be the truth, right? It has to be the truth. And he gives so many different quotations. They'll list all 18 Puranas, and they'll say, of all these Puranas, Bhagavatam is the highest. So go read Srimad Bhagavatam. For all these reasons, and several others, right? Oh yeah, I should mention a few others. He also shows how the Bhagavatam is in fact contains the meaning of the entire Vedanta Sutra within it. The very first sutra of Vedanta Sutra is Janmadhyasya Yataha. The very first words of Srimad Bhagavatam, Janmadhyasya Yataha. Right? The Bhagavatam is the and he quotes a verse from Garuda Puran to make this point. The Garuda Puran says, Arthoyam Brahma Sutranam. The meaning of all the Brahma Sutras is this Srimad Bhagavatam. It also contains the meaning of the Gayatri. For those of you who chant Gayatri, right, the key word there is dhimahi. And the Bhagavatam ends, the first verse, with that. Satyam param dhimahi. He shows how the meaning of each of the Vedic literatures, the four Vedas, the various Puranas, etc., is all found in the Srimad Bhagavatam. He demonstrates all of this systematically. So that the Bhagavatam is not only the highest of all Vedic literatures, but also contains all the Vedic literatures within it. It's inclusive of them. It's not just rejecting them, but it's actually including. Anything you want to achieve from the other Vedic literatures, you can get from Bhagavatam also. So by the end of Tattva Sandarbha, he's made it crystal clear. He's kind of proven it. That when it comes to Srimad Bhagavatam, there's nothing that beats it. There's nothing that's higher than it. The next step in his argument is to show or to prove that Srimad Bhagavatam is actually teaching Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy. Right? This is how he's going to then show that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy is the highest. The Bhagavatam is the highest source of knowledge, and Srimad Bhagavatam teaches Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy. And that's where things get a little difficult and interesting. Because to demonstrate what the Bhagavatam is actually teaching or what it means, it's not such an easy task. This is a work of 18,000 verses and very, very elaborate. So how do we determine what the meaning of the Bhagavatam is? And that's going to be the topic of the next session of our seminar. Namely, understanding or figuring out what actually the deepest meaning, the ultimate meaning of Srimad Bhagavatam is, and how we should study this Srimad Bhagavatam. Okay? So we're going to kind of dive deeper into the ocean of the Srimad Bhagavatam as it progresses. before I finish, any questions that are lingering or remain? Yes, Prue. Is it okay if we start reading Bhagavatam without without what? Oh, yes, yes. In fact, not only is it okay, but it's recommended. It means if the mind is not confused by a lot of other things, all that kaitava dharma, then it becomes easier to leave that behind, you know? So Bhagavatam, it'll begin from ABC. It'll begin from point number one. This is why what Prabhupada was saying in the preface when we read. If you begin with first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam, it starts with the very first point of any spiritual process. Janmadyasya yataha. Acknowledge the existence of a God who is the creator of everything that exists, its maintainer and its destroyer. Right? Just the basic. Atato brahma jignyasa. Now let us inquire into the absolute truth. This is the first step in self-realization. Satyam param dhimahi. Atato brahma jignyasa. Same meaning is there. Right? So Bhagavatam begins right from ABCD, and by the ninth canto, we'll be self-realized. By the end of the tenth canto, we'll be devotees of the Lord. Yeah? Yeah. Yes. Yes. In terms of the quality of the product it's offering, but it doesn't... See, the only prerequisite that the Bhagavatam places, it doesn't say you have to read all these literatures to come to Bhagavatam. Its quality is much better than these other literatures. But the only prerequisite the Bhagavatam says, nirmatsaranam satam, that make sure your heart is clean. Right? That you're going to study Bhagavatam for the purpose of knowing about Krishna. That you don't want to misuse the Bhagavatam. You know, like people go to the 10th canto, for example. They like to read Krishna's Rasila. Why? It's nice, you know, it gives them excited that Krishna is doing Rasi like this. So many Indian films and so on, they all, this Radha Krishna Leela, they're interested in. Why? They're also reading Bhagavatam, but not Nirmat Saranam Satam. It has to be with the mood of actually knowing about Krishna, about learning Krishna. So if our mood is right, if our attitude is correct, then there's no other prerequisite that's needed. Not necessary. It's nice to study Bhagavad Gita first. It's good. Bhagavad Gita is philosophically fundamental. Right? But nothing is necessary. Bhagavatam is complete in and of itself. And in the introduction, Prabhupada says that the first verse begins with the very basics and the 10th canto ends with the highest point. So you actually don't need any other literature other than Bhagavatam. Nothing more is required to study or read inner Krishna consciousness. Nothing. It's all there. So just our mood has to be right. That's all. Okay. Yes, Prue. Yeah.
So again, maybe in the next session when you're showing, sharing, so what aspect or what angle actually we should be taking the essence there? Because it appears more like a narration or illustration with, you know, a lot of detail.
Yes, yes.
Even certain things where you cannot express or being expressed, but as a, you know, individual or as a human being, you know, what aspect actually is, we have to look at, or what's the takeaway for us?
Yeah.
We have to do
Yeah, no, that's a good question. How? What do we take away from the reading of the various steps of Bhagavatam? You see, Bhagavatam, each canto will bring us to a higher level of spiritual understanding. Okay, first canto, second, third, like that. So, it often what will happen is if we study Bhagavatam seriously, we will find that we are dealing with the same problems and the same issues and confusions as are the stories and the devotees and the demons in the story we're reading, in the canto we're at. In other words, we'll notice the Bhagavatam extracting these same things from our heart, from pulling it out. And this is why Prabhupada, for example, he said, first two cantos of Bhagavatam you can use for mass distribution. In other words, give it to people even on the street, because it'll get to them to the point of removing the gross material desires and sinful activities. Illicit sex, meat eating, gambling, intoxication, all of that. As you continue reading Bhagavatam, you'll see that the stories, the kathas of the Bhagavatam, are not some far out, ancient stories of faraway places and Mahabhagavat devotees that we can never aspire to be. They are. But the stories are given specifically so that we can learn and advance from them. So, for example, a brahmachari, right? He's been serving in the temple, living in the temple for so many years, doing so much seva, distributing books nonstop, 10 years, worshipping the deities, doing puja and so on. One day after all these years of seva, he comes in front of Shishi Gaura Nithai and he says, "My dear Lord, I'm so embarrassed to say this. I know I should be better than this, all these years of bhakti, but I want to get married. Can you find me a wife, please? And make her pretty, too." And so, lo and behold, one very well-known, respected grihastha walks into the temple that Sunday feast, and his daughters of marriageable age, and he's looking for a bride, and they happen to see each other, and within a few months they're married, right? And then no one sees them around anymore, right? Or once a week maybe. This guy used to do so much seva, and everyone's saying, complete maya, just see what happens, right? Just see, he's completely in maya. Next time he shows up, Rolex watch, driving a Rolls Royce, really stylish, silk dhoti, nicely pressed. Mataji's in a wonderful sari, nice bangles, gold jewelry. Evan goes, you know who he used to be, this guy? He was one of our best preachers in the temple. And he was one of the most renounced sadhus we had. And look at him now. What happened? And we might criticize, But then he has children. And those children, you never know who they might grow up to be, right? Maybe the Supreme Lord might take birth as this child. This is direct from Srimad Bhagavatam, this story, right? Whose story am I telling? Kardama Muni and Devahuti, right? This is their story, exactly. Kardama Muni is a pure self-realized sage. He's done years of tapasya and devotional service. And he does all this tapasya, and when Krishna comes in front of him, what does he ask him? "Please give me your pure bhakti." No. He says, "Give me a wife." Imagine you're seeing Lord Vishnu on the back of Garuda face to face. And he says, "My Lord, I'm embarrassed to ask you this, but I want a wife." And he says, "Don't worry, I already know. I already know. And just after I leave, Swayambhuva Manu will show up with his daughter. She's very beautiful, very qualified. He's looking for a husband for her, and he's going to offer her hand in marriage to you. You should accept." Right? They get married, and then for 10,000 years, no one sees them around anymore. He's got his Rolls Royce and his Mercedes and his Rolex watch and everything. Right? He's flying in airplanes and living on palaces and enjoying like anything. But then, after those anarthas, those desires are there in the heart. You get through them. One more time, we have to go through them. Then they both kind of shake themselves clean and go, "Okay, now what was the purpose of life again?" And specifically Devahuti, she's worried. She says, "I'm afraid. Right? I'm afraid. One day you're going to be gone. I know it. One day I'm going to be afraid, fearful, on my own. It's your duty to give me fearlessness." And Kardama Muni says, "Okay, I'll do that." And he gives her a son. And that son is Kapiladev, right? Who is the Supreme Lord himself who comes down. He teaches his mother, Devahuti, sends her back to Godhead and liberates the whole world through his teachings of Sankhya. So the point is, that story, that description that is found in third canto Bhagavatam is a story of very advanced devotees. It's a story from a faraway land in a faraway time. But it's our story too. And we'll find that as we're reading Bhagavatam, the various anarthas, the various desires, the various situations that we find ourselves in life will be there in Bhagavatam. In fact, it's the other way around. Bhagavatam will get those out from our heart. Right? This is why Prabhupada is saying it's important to be progressive in your study. Because the Bhagavatam says, okay, now you're ready to deal with this anartha. So first anartha, gross sensual activities. Gross sensual activities. Okay, got rid of those first two cantos. But now you're doing your dharma, following Vedic rules, and you're a grihastha, and you're doing nicely, and you're doing seva in the temple, and you think you're just fine, right? You think you've made it. Ah, now, time to pull that out. Sense gratification according to religious principles. That anartha is more subtle than sense gratification against religious principles. Against religious principles, okay, most of us, we've got a pretty good idea not to touch that. Right? We've worked it out. But that subtle anartha, sense gratification according to religious principles, still an anartha. Third canto Bhagavatam, we're going to pull it out. Fourth, fifth, sixth, like this. And the anarthas get more and more subtle, more and more powerful. You get the story of Jad Bharat, right? What was his anartha? Very subtle. Very subtle. What was his anartha? Yeah, affection. But it wasn't like Kardama Muni's affection. What was his affection like? Yeah, to protect the weak. Right? He was being incredibly compassionate. And you say, okay, Kardama Muni's I can understand. It's an anartha. Right? He wanted to enjoy. Wife, family, husband, everything. Okay, but Bharat Maharaj, he left all of that, family and home. And you're penalizing him for just taking care of someone who's suffering? No, that wasn't the problem. What was the anartha? Surhidam sarvabhutanam. Right? This feeling, this thinking that I am in fact the friend of all living entities. I'm actually going to help everyone around me. Right? That's a very subtle anartha. Even you become self-realized, yogi, jnani, this and that. The greatest, most selfless person in the world, the greatest philanthropist, where your whole life is meant for the welfare of others. And yet, still it's impure. Why? Because we're thinking, Suhridam sarvabhutanam. I am the friend of all living entities. I'm going to help that poor guy and that poor guy and that poor guy. Let me help her and let me help him. All come to me. Right? I'll help. And that feeling, subtle feeling. Statue of Liberty has this anartha very badly. Right? Bring me all your tired and huddled masses. Right? Suhridam sarvabhutanam. I'm the friend of all living entities. Very subtle, but it needs to get out of our heart before we can do pure bhakti. Story of Jad Bharat deals with that. So this is why. Bhagavatam is a very practical book. And if we just study it sincerely and clearly every day, it'll get out all these things out of our heart. It'll pull them out until the heart is crystal clear. It's clean like a mirror. And then we come to the 10th canto and we can relish that Krishna Leela. Ah, oh, it's so nice. Because the heart is not dirty anymore. Okay, we've gone over time.